Yeah, money, your usage of money is going to affect your happiness one way or the other. There's no getting around it.
Oh, wait, say that one more time, because that is so powerful.
So certainly the amount of money, but also your usage of whatever money you do have is going to affect your happiness for better or worse. So you might as well make it for better.
That is not a neutral experience, right? We cannot avoid the impact of how we're either earning or spending money. Welcome to the Healthy Love and Money podcast. If you find money to be the number one, two, or even third largest source of stress in your relationship, then you're in the right place. Going beyond how to budget, invest, and do your taxes, we're going to explore financial intimacy. Discover how to talk with your partner about your shared financial life. Let's take the awkward and painful out of money conversations. Join me and hit follow to listen to weekly inspiring, healing, and motivating interviews with financial therapists, couples therapists, and financial planners, and so many more. Let's go on the journey of financial intimacy together. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Healthy Love and Money podcast. Today, it's my distinct honor to welcome Professor Scott Rick to the show. Scott, you have just released this incredible book called Tightwads and Spendthrifts, Navigating the Money Minefield in Real Relationships. And I've given it a quick read through to prepare for this interview. It had me in laughter and tears within the first few pages. So I am so thrilled to have you here on the show. Welcome.
Ed, thank you so much. Those are just the kind of feelings I was hoping it would elicit. So we're off to a good start.
Now, help listeners get oriented. How in the world did you get so interested in people's behaviors and feelings and money and this little dilemma of tightwads and spendthrifts?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a spendthrift raised by spendthrifts, and we had kind of a unusual upbringing where my grandparents lived in town in Houston and with all the grandkids, and it was nice, but they just kind of got bored and decided to move to Vegas. They're kind of show people. They used to run like movie theaters and restaurants. They need the action. So it was sad, but we got to go out there for like weeks at a time and hang out in Vegas. And, you know, we weren't like looking at the scenery or Hoover Dam. We were in the casinos. And so, yeah, it was kind of a fascinating daily pursuit of happiness via money. And, you know, I got to see some suboptimal financial choices, not anything overboard, but, you know, definitely a lot of questionable things. And it was fascinating, and it just felt very normal to me. But over the years, I started noticing like, oh, other families don't seem to have this approach. They're not as loosey-goosey as ours was.
Right.
And so, yeah, just these differences started just being very apparent over time. And so I got very curious about kind of what makes the two types tick.
Now, you said something that is always near and dear to my heart is I got curious. And so you're not just any ordinary professor. Can you tell people a little bit about your professional identity and background?
Sure. Well, I went to grad school for what's called behavioral decision research, basically behavioral science, kind of a mix of economists and psychologists running around. And
well, the cocktail parties are really fun with that group, aren't they?
Yeah. You get into some strange stuff. And so, yeah, it seemed like a great place to kind of investigate kind of shopping and kind of the psychology of it. And, you know, when I was younger, like my first study was like having people shop while having their brain scanned with functional MRI. And that was kind of the hot thing at the time. But over the years, a lot of kind of surveys and experiments, and now with couples, we do experiments with couples too. That's an adventure.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the adventure of working with couples, going from studying individuals to studying couples. Mm-hmm. And yes. I just want listeners to roll back the tape for just a moment and notice that you said fMRIs and spending. And so what I want listeners to know is, because if you're not in this little bubble of world, you don't know that research is being done looking at actual brain activity and spending, but there's actually a pretty good body of literature out there. So what I want people to walk away is you don't have to become a scientist, but to know that there is very real, very rigorous, you use the word rigorous behavioral science in the book. And I love that. So I just want people to know that this is not just Scott's laying on the side of the hill on the grass, looking in the clouds and be like, you know, this is how I think couples and money work. This is based in decades of research, not only your own, but a broader community. So by yes. way of context.
That's right. Yeah. And certainly research is not nailed down.
It's not a perfect, no.
Yeah. But I kind of felt like, okay, I have enough to go on that I think I can provide some valuable yeah. advice to people. And yeah. So, you know, moving towards couples, it's, you know, again, there's a lot of research involved. I am married to a tight wad and kind of got interested in, do other couples kind of have these interesting differences and how do they navigate them? And it turns out a lot are kind of mismatched like us.
A lot are mismatched. A tightwad marries a spendthrift. And I'm curious, do you see maybe two tightwads partnering and then one takes on a spendthrift position to kind of balance the scale? And I ask that because that's, to some extent, I feel like what happened in our marriages. I was mm-hmm. much more on the tightwad side of things. My wife was finishing grad school. She didn't have a lot, but she didn't spend much either. So that was very attractive initially. But mm-hmm. we've been married 17 years and I've noticed that like I've loosened up in a lot of ways on spending to kind of try to balance the scales, if you will. Not in a conscious, like, let me make sure that we're balancing this thing.
So, yeah, that is one flavor. When couples are truly mismatched, if things are going well, then they'll often kind of come closer to each other.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, no, I mean, sometimes you get kind of thrust into a role. Like,
yeah.
let's say the tightwad partner has to do a lot of household shopping. And if there are kids involved and like, you know, eventually it's like a pitcher, your arm eventually gets warmed up and you kind of get used to it. And it's,
right.
you can't just walk around in agony all the time, in pain.
Right.
And so you find a way to live with it. And so there can be that differentiation too. It's interesting paths that different couples take.
That's so interesting the way you framed it. Just with that pitching arm and like, you got to get used to having to take a certain action over and over again. And if that's going to be your defined action, you've got to figure out a way to live with it. And if you don't have the right physical therapist, if I can build on the analogy a little bit to help you do it right, you're going to start throwing funky balls because you're in so much pain having to be the pitcher.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. Interesting.
So yeah, and it's hard to anticipate this stuff, by the way, when you're dating and kind of seeing 10, 20 years down the road, kind of
right.
who's going to have to take on these different roles.
No, I mean, I saw that. Like I did the household bill paying and financial planning and projecting early on in our marriage. And then her dental practice was up and going. So I took on more of that because I was the money guy. But then like life shifted and we had a kid and I got involved in more graduate school and I wasn't paying as much attention. So then she took it over. And as she took it over, I started paying even less attention. Right. And so that like there can be these role reversals over a long arc of an intimate relationship. Too. Do you see that in the research?
Yeah. It's like Taylor Swift eras. I mean,
yes.
Yeah, of course. And there are these opportunities to change if you have kind of a tendency that you're not in love with. There are these fresh starts.
Ooh. So before we start going down that, because that's, I think what we'll want to pay attention to is, okay, great. Who am I as a person relating to money? But then it's like, what do I do in light of that? So in the beginning of the book on page 9, you have this tightwad spendthrift score. And just before I hit record, I did go back and read the footnotes to see what's changed because I'm that on the nerd side. It's 4 questions, Scott. And it's not just, again, this is not just Scott coming up with 4 questions he thinks is cool. I'm guessing it went through a whole scientific process of identifying the questions that most accurately predict the construct, the science language. So can you tell us a little bit about this 4 question assessment?
Yeah. Well, it's trying to understand where people fall along a continuum. And it's really kind of, are you more on an extreme where you feel like you should be spending, but you just can't bring yourself to do it because you get too anxious or too worried about what you're missing out on later. That's one end. That's like the tight one end. Or are you more close to someone who, you know, realizes you don't need something, but it's kind of appealing and you can't resist and you don't have a lot of pain or distress stopping you? That's the spendthrift end. It's, I like to say it's like someone cut the brakes on the car. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's just, it doesn't need to be something like totally so appealing or fascinating. It's like, oh, that might be nice. Yeah, I'll go ahead and get that. It's a low bar that.
Oh, and can I, these things have can to I do. Ask yeah. a question on that spendthrift, like ease of spending? Because something that I'm noticing in my own life is there's certain areas where it's like, man, I will whip out my credit card faster than anything. Let's just name it a business training course. We'll call it a big category. Like, it's something that will help me grow my business. Man, I'm willing to just, it just bypasses any kind of reasoning. But like, my son wants new Air Jordans and both my wife and I are like, no. Right. So it's not like spendthrifts are just yes to everything. They usually, does your research show that they kind of have yes to certain categories or of goods or services?
Yeah, no, there can be some category variation, and spendthrifts are kind of gifted in looking at something through the lens of like, oh, this is an investment in something later. So like, certainly a business.
That's the framing, right?
But like, you know, for me, like if my kid wants the Air Jordans, first of all, I love Air Jordans, but second, it's like, oh, well, the kid will be more comfortable at school and maybe they'll be more outgoing and make better friends and they'll be more confident. And so like, I can twist it and fiddle with it and get there. But yeah, no, spendthrifts are yes to most things.
So your research shows they're actually yes to many things, maybe not just a tight category.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It depends on how it's presented, but they're... Sure. A true gifted spendthrift they'll find a way.
Oh, I love this. A gifted spendthrift. You know, I can't resist. I've got to go back to this Air Jordans. The reason why it popped out is we're going to a family wedding in 2 weeks, right? And so the bride and groom are going to wear Jordans at the rehearsal dinner, or at the reception rather.
Okay.
And so, you know, my son is not in the wedding party, but he wants to be a part of it. So I have to have the Jordans, Dad. I have to have them. Which, you know, brings consternation from our wife and I. We're like, hey, you already have other nice shoes we just bought. You don't need this particular one thing. So that may get too in the weeds about tight wads and spendthrifts. But it was interesting because he was asking, he's 13. And so he was asking like, well, did you ever have the coolest shoes? And as we're talking now, I realized like, no, because my parents were probably more on the tight wad end of the continuum. And this is why I want to tie this back together is you use a continuum, not a, you are definitively this or you're definitively that. Now, if you're further out the continuum, you're probably more definitively a spendthrift or a tightwad. And you said gifted spendthrift. So I'm guessing those are like the people that are really far out on the continuum of being spendthrifts.
Right. Maxing out.
Maxing it out. Wow. I just said too much. Let me reorient here. Sorry, listeners.
We're both processing here.
We're both processing. People that listen to this regularly, they know Ed just goes on some rabbit trails here. So. I'm not a, you know, hey, look, I'm not a trained media person. I'm a therapist, financial planner, just pretending to be a podcast host. Let's talk a little bit more about this continuum and how people can use it to help themselves.
Yeah, no, I think it is useful to see kind of where you are compared to others, compared to like a partner.
Yeah.
You know, we give data on kind of where other people have fallen on this dimension. And it's, you know, it can be kind of reassuring or kind of eye-opening, like, oh, I'm in the top or bottom 1% of this distribution. That's interesting. But yeah, I think with, once you kind of know roughly where you are, like there are different recommendations based on that and kind of how you can modify, if you have the taste for that, your approach. And retailers are all, already kind of helping, trying to help tightwads modify themselves and loosen up.
Yeah.
But spendthrifts, you're kind of much more on your own. You got to be kind of entrepreneurial in kind of, no one's looking to help you stop spending. So you have to create your own speed bumps and friction to slow yourself down.
You kind of draw on, you were using the brake analogy before, is it's almost like tightwads have the brake on all the time or a lot of the time. And spendthrifts like don't know where the brake pedal is.
Yeah, tightwads, it's like someone accidentally put on the emergency brake and you're just driving the van on.
I'm trying to go, but why can't I go? Yeah. And I'm going to tie this into the my lens of the financial therapy in just a moment. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about couples and why going through this type of assessment is important for couples to go through this assessment together for both of them.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good conversation starter, and it's good to compare how I see you versus how you see yourself. And that could be very different. Yeah. Like I can guess how you would fill it out, and then I see how you fill it out. And that could be like, oh, interesting, you saw it that way. Why is that? And you can kind of learn a little bit about each other. And you know, that's a approach that is kind of throughout this book. Like you need kind of curiosity about your partner's inner psychological world and kind of how they see themselves. But no, that can help to reframe some past behaviors that might have been confusing or off-putting. And it's like, oh, well, they didn't get me this terrible gift because they don't love me or don't understand me. I was just, oh yeah, they really, really hate to spend money. Like that's why they got me this cheap watch that I hate. It's that they have this. So it's just kind of context to put kind of choices and statements in context.
Scott, you just helped me. I just got a moment of a flash of clarity for myself. And this is why I love psychology and I'm so challenged by it, is because there are different ways to look at and see ourselves to understand any one dynamic, right? But I just flashed back to a few years ago, my wife and I celebrated our 15th anniversary. And you know, when we got married, like most young couples, we were not well endowed financially. And so me, especially being a former firefighter, I spent very little money. I was fortunate to have some very small diamonds from my grandmother's ring, not worth a whole lot, but I put it in a nice new fresh setting and off we went. So fast forward 15 years and my wife and I were more financially established. It's appropriate to get her a nicer ring, but that tightwad lens of mine was on. And so I was like, I'm just gonna, I was at Costco and I was like, this ring looks a lot like the much fancier rings, but it is not nearly as expensive. I'm going to go with this.
Yeah.
And then, you know, gave it to her and it ruffled some feathers. And my wife is a very gracious, very modest person by and large, but there is that the meaning of like how much you spend on certain, especially sentimental items, does connote for many people that sense of how much do you value me? And
yeah. Yeah.
Man, it gets misconstrued in what that actual meaning, because I love my wife immensely, but I just don't have that conditioning that spending lots of money on a diamond ring helps convey that anymore.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's fascinating. By the way, do they just have those in the back? Like they send a runner to go get a diamond ring at the register?
Well, I was at Costco and they just, you know, I mean, they have the display space and then you get the little ticket from the person and you go check out and then they have it in the safe.
Wow.
Scott, I'm embarrassed. Okay. For all the public to know, I think it was like $1,500, $2,000. We're going to hear. And what I know as a planner and as a therapist and maybe just as human, is some people are going to hear that and be like, dang, Ed, you are cheap. Mm. And some people are going to be like, dang, Ed, why'd you spend so much money? Like it all, context matters so much for how we hear any one number. So
yeah,
the number is not really that important per se, but yeah, this money stuff just, it's so interesting, endlessly interesting. That's why I do the podcast.
Did you reveal that it was from Costco or?
Yes, I think, yes. I will have to double check with her, but I hope I didn't just let a cat out of the bag. I'm pretty sure she knew. Yeah, because you know she would see the bill on the credit card statement, right?
Sure.
And we had been talking about it, and it's not that she wanted one that was really 10 times more valuable, but it was just kind of maybe there was some tightwad. There's also just I just want to get through this and be done with it.
So, yeah, sure.
Anyhow.
Well, you know, I have this chapter on gift giving, and you know, the editors and were like, are you sure? Like, does that warrant a whole chapter? I was like, at least a chapter.
That could be a whole book. I'm pretty sure.
But yeah, these gift giving occasions are just very crucial moments to kind of communicate what we know about them, our partners, and how much we appreciate them. And one of the important things is like sacrifice. Like, I need to know that this was not easy for you to acquire or find. But so it can be something very nice. But if I know that you just got it while picking up cat food at Costco, you know, this was just part of your
normal, like, I was just in Costco. And by the way, I just happened to pick up your updated engagement ring. Instead of being like, I saved, I went to the local jeweler, I talked with them, I researched. Interest. So I could
have. Yeah, for spendthrifts especially, like, we can't kind of throw money at things because our partners know that that's no big deal for us. They see us buy overpriced things all the time. And like, oh, even if I got my partner like a new iPad, like, it's expensive, it's nice.
Right.
But she just saw me buy myself a new iPhone. Like, it's nothing to me. I don't care about things.
Yes.
There's no sacrifice there. It's not bought less, but it's, you know, it's...
It's not as... compared to like a true tightwad spouse who never buys anything nice, if they came home with an iPad...
That's something.
That'd be like, oh... So, and this is like, as humans, context matters so stinking much.
Welcome to 2024, and thank you for listening to the Healthy Love and Money podcast. I'd like to take you behind the scenes of therapy-informed financial planning, where we talk about emotions, we talk about retirement plans, we talk about painful family experiences with money, and so much more. There's no need to hide things that leave you feeling embarrassed or ashamed about your financial situation. This year, we watch couples and individuals work through financial anxiety and start talking lovingly about money. We saw couples and individuals take action towards their goals, like closing a business that no longer fit them, paying off debt that felt crushing, increasing their comfort with their realized wealth, and ultimately overcoming some of those financial secrets that had been plaguing the relationship. Ultimately, the best part was seeing smiles return to our clients' faces about life, relationships, and money. This is why we do therapy-informed financial planning. I invite you to make 2024 the year you start therapy-informed financial planning. Check the show notes below to schedule your free 30-minute consultation.
So what I want listeners to know is, Scott, you just gave a great financial therapy exercise. I don't know if you intended to do it that way. You don't probably claim it as a financial therapy exercise, but hey, I'm going to take everything I can to call it a financial therapy exercise. So this quiz, get Scott's book, right? Tightwads and Spendthrifts, get you to page 9. So you can make it that far in the book. I know most people quit halfway through, so you'll be there.
Yeah.
But page 9 and 10 has the quiz. It's 4 questions. But here's the couple's exercise. Fill it out for yourself, and then fill it out for your spouse. Have your spouse fill it out for themselves. Have them fill it out for you. Then pour your favorite drink, glass of wine, glass of bourbon, beer, non-alcoholic bev, whatever works for you guys, and talk through why you scored yourself the way you did and why you scored your partner. Now, keep in mind, we want to bring empathy, love, and compassion to this conversation. If you're coming with guns blazing, don't go there. Just don't go there. Call me up. Let's have a conversation. I'll get you through it. I don't think you want couples calling you to work them through this conversation. Is that a fair assumption? Like, you can sign up for one of his classes at the University of Michigan, but like, you don't want to play couples therapist.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to leave that to the professionals. But no, I do enjoy kind of hearing stories and, you know, talking to people when possible. But no, I'm totally fascinated by the whole financial therapy practice and approach.
Well, can we talk about that for a minute and why, like, I'm so in love with this book immediately, and I'm going to give it a much deeper read and probably go through it multiple times. I am going to do this. I'm just committing here when people hear it. If you're a client of mine, you will be getting 2 copies of this in your physical mailbox. I will be sending it from Amazon to you, 2 copies, 1 for you, 1 for your spouse, because that's how big of a deal I think this book is. I think it gives such approachable language and makes it so disarming that there's no judgment if you're a tightwad or a spendthrift or in the middle. And that's the starting place for me in financial therapy is, we check judgment at the door, and that's easier said than done. But Financial therapy also raises a very interesting question, because it says, what is actually healthy, right? And in that, there's a lot of kind of moral implications and judgment that goes into that. And so this is a sensitive subject, because I don't want to pathologize a spendthrift or a tightwad. And at the same time, there may be some real adverse implications for relational health and financial well-being. And so, you know, when I look at that unconflicted consumer that's in the middle scale,
yeah,
it's someone that's found some balance between these two. And to some extent, it does connote probably a healthier on average approach. So is that part of the intended meaning? Do you get where I'm going with all of this?
Exactly. No, they are the most at peace with their approach to money. And that's why they get that name. And the implication is that tightwads and spendthrifts, there is some conflict, inner conflict about that. You asked how, you know, you give people the scale and ask, how happy are you with the answers you just gave me? And you get kind of an inverted U, where the extremes are both kind of least happy, and then unconflicted, they're happy with it. And so even though tightwads look good on paper, they still are kind of wrestling with, like, I should have done some more fun stuff with that money.
So they have the regret experience often. And so this is not something, I don't know, I didn't see it if you wrote about it in the book about using this scale, but in your research with folks, couples, is inverted U, meaning people on the further ends of tightwad or spendthrift are least happy with that way of being. Way of being is a wow.
That aspect of themselves.
Aspect. This is not maybe an all-encompassing thing. But to some extent, we are saying if we can move to more, and it's not a particular exact point on the continuum, it's more of a zone, right? And part of what you shared I liked is it's scored, minimum score is 4, max score is 26. And 4 to 11 is for tightwad, and 19 to 26 is for spendthrift. So what you write is like, hey, if you're a 19, you're really close to an unconflicted consumer. You're probably not that strong. And kind of reverse tightwad, if you're at an 11, like, you might have a few tightwad tendencies, but it's not that extreme. And man, dude, our brains are so wired for black and white.
Yes.
And really discreet, like taking on, like, because some people wear it as a badge of honor. I'm a tightwad, or I'm a spendthrift, right? Like, it's a badge of honor, put on the superhero cape, but like, maybe not so much. We need to be that way.
That's right. Exactly. And, you know, even myself over the years with the research, I used to think about it very categorically, but no, it's clearly just a continuous thing. And the difference between a 19 and an 18, it's, you know, you get different labels, but psychologically, it's not a big thing.
Right. There's actually a bigger difference between it being a 4 tightwad and an 11 tightwad than being 11 tightwad, 12 unconflicted consumer.
Yeah.
So the next question is, how do babies come out of the womb and end up somewhere along this continuum? What are some of those big factors that the research shows about that drives people towards these continuums?
Yeah. No, I think there are like demographic predictors. Men tend to be more tightwad than women. It's a small thing, but it's there. They tend to be more mathematical.
Yeah.
Tightwads tend to be more mathy major.
Tightwads tend to be, like, from a educational background standpoint, are more mathematical. Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
And yeah, I think if you are someone just kind of born to kind of ruminate and worry, I would say that is kind of a more tightwad kind of approach to, that's kind of a tightwad friendly brain, I would say.
Okay, right.
Yes. And very, you know, tightwads are very future oriented, whereas spendthrifts are more kind of in the moment.
Right.
In the present.
Yeah.
You know, spendthrifts are often aware of what might happen in the future. Like, oh, I might get tired of this new fun product, but I just don't care about that much. I care more about what's now.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I think a lot of it is what we see in formative times in our youth and adolescence. And parents give a lot of conflicting signals. you know, give a lot of verbal advice. Like, I know I've been like, hey, get off screens, guys. I got to check my Twitter here, but you should get off screen.
Oh, the conflicted money messages from mom and dad.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Like, right. Oh, you don't need to, you get this gift from grandma, this gift card. Like, oh, you don't need to spend it right away, but check out the new cool stuff I got at Target. Like, so that's the question. Like, what are they more likely to pick up on?
Well, and I think what's interesting is when I, you know, in talking to families, and I'm usually talking to one sibling of multiple siblings, but you talk to enough people about their sibling experiences and you realize each sibling has their own position in the family. And so you get this age-old adage, how do we come out so different? We're from the same family. But there are multiple explanations. There's a personality explanation, there's a gender explanation, there's a sibling position way of looking at it. There's also like a developmental, like how old were you when you had this experience relative to your other siblings? Where were your parents in their lifespan of development? So there's, I share all this, not to overwhelm folks, but to say like, this is kind of a complex calculus that leads any one of us towards one or the other sides of this imbalance.
Which absolutely.
Is that part of what makes the change process also challenging? Can we start to talk a little bit about, okay, so you're identifying maybe more on the tight water to spendthrift. What are some of your findings, research back around the process of change towards a more unconflicted consumer?
Yes. Well, I think it, in both cases, a lot of it comes down to understanding your tendencies, understanding what your future self might do, the mistakes that they might make.
Yeah.
And kind of taking steps to prevent those mistakes in the future by acting now. And so I think, you know, we tend to think of like budgeting as a way to reel in spending.
Yeah.
But I think tightwads can use it maybe with a different phrasing. Maybe it's a spending plan.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But they can use it to loosen up and commit to, okay, I'm going to set aside X dollars for optional things I haven't considered before, but like might be fun purchases in advance, because in the moment, the tightwad is not able to justify the purchase. They can't conjure up an explanation or they can't find the money for it. And so they pass on it. But if they can pre-commit to, I have this amount earmarked for more fun things, then it's there, it's waiting for them. And so they can take that step to lock themselves in.
I really want listeners to pick up on this, right? Because if you're on the tightwad side or the spendthrift side, the way you experience, and I'm going to say budget because that's what most people talk about, but I'm also a financial planner. And so the financial planner is more on that retirement savings, long-term net worth growth side of things. And what we see in the financial planning world, when you put two tightwads together, they are like an ideal financial planning couple.
Yep.
They're wanting to maximize their savings. They're wanting to do all the right things. They're willing to listen. And you tell them you need to save $1,000, like, cool, I'll do $1,200, right? Meanwhile, you work with spendthrifts don't make it to the financial planner's office by and large until they've really hit some trouble. And then for me, maybe it's me and not all planners, but it's like trying to pull teeth to convince them that saving $50 for next month will be a good thing. Like, it's really challenging, depending on the severity, right?
Yes.
But that's, you know, as a financial therapist, that's therapists in the general meet people on the more extreme end of experiences, whatever it is, right? Because that's until it causes enough pain, we don't go to therapy. We go to coaching or the gym. Mm. You know, I use a gym analogy a lot as like, hey, we go to the gym if we're generally able to take ourselves to the gym and go there. But once we get injured, we roll the ankle. It's like, stop going to the gym. You go to the therapist, rehab. And financial therapists are kind of that when you're financially injured, air quotes.
Mm-hmm.
You need some rehab so that you can get back on the money game and play it more effectively. But you know, this is where like, if what I'm thinking about is budgeting, financial planning, two spendthrifts, the budget financial plan can help guide you on how much you need to be saving. And for two tightwads together, it almost can guide you on how much to be spending. Like that kind of permission to spend, if you will.
Yes.
And if you're a spendthrift and a tightwad, then it's like, how do you stop rowing the boat in a circle? Right? Because it's like one person is like spend, spend, spend. The other person's like save, save, save. And it's spinning the boat in circles. And that doesn't really feel fun after a while.
Yes. Yeah. No. Yeah. I think getting an outside perspective can help kind of get you back on the right track. I tell a story in the book about a mother who was reaching, an older woman kind of reaching end of life, and she was very much a tightwad, and her, saw her daughter kind of following in her tightwad footsteps, and kind of told her, don't be like me. You set aside whatever per month, and you just, that's what you have fun with. You promise me that you'll do that. And, and the daughter kind of ended up living kind of a happier existence by committing to that and got kind of this permission and to do so. But yeah, it's planning, budgeting can be helpful on both sides, fun or necessary saving.
But there's this classic phrase that gets floated out a lot. Money can't buy you happiness. Hmm. And I would almost think spendthrifts would make a very strong counter argument. And tightwads wouldn't. I don't know. This is matriculating through my head as we're talking. But I do think for me, where I've landed is that money can facilitate happy experiences, right? If we're thoughtful about it, right?
Of course.
It can also drive us into misery if we're not thoughtful about it. And that probably is true on the tightwad and the spendthrift side.
Yeah, money, your usage of money is going to affect your happiness one way or the other. There's no getting around it.
Oh, wait, say that one more time, because that is so powerful.
So certainly the amount of money, but also your usage of whatever money you do have is going to affect your happiness for better or worse. So you might as well make it for better.
That is not a neutral experience, right? We cannot avoid the impact of how we're either earning or spending money. And I think I went through a period of time where I kind of, as I was trying to figure out this whole psychology of money and where, how do I relate, I did go for a period of time into the state of mind like, oh, well, the way to truly be happy with money is to avoid it. Mm. Like, don't worry about making it and don't worry about spending it. Just like kind of almost become a monk, if you will. And there were some spiritual influences that were precipitating some of that, right? But that's this kind of distancing from money side of things. And I don't know how that fits with tightwad spendthrift.
That does sound like a more spendthrift approach. Like, tightwads are more money-minded and just more interested in it. And
whereas spendthrifts are kind of more like absent-minded, not don't worry about it, the consequences. It's not that big of a deal. It's everything will work out. Like, those are kind of common narratives just beneath the surface.
Exactly.
So yeah, I can see that, right? Because it's kind of for me, it was a little bit of the trust God, God will provide angle on things where like you don't have to worry about it. Like, if you just are faithful, it will all kind of work out. And it's like, well, that didn't really work out. So, wow. There is so much richness to your book. And I just want to read a couple of the chapter headings.
Oh, sure.
Get influenced, then influence yourself. Fiscal fatal attraction. Ask me no questions and I'll tell you no lies. Those are just a few of the chapter headings. How the heck did you come up with these incredible chapter headings? And I'm wanting to hook people in to be like, whoa, what's in fiscal fatal attraction?
Well, that is, you know, describing the tendency for people with different approaches to end up with each other.
Yeah.
And the idea of the fatal part is there's often kind of what draws us in about someone, like if they're different in some intriguing way, can be fun at first, but less so as things change. So like if I'm kind of so taken by your kind of professional success and kind of, I think it's cool to be around someone who does like cool things. I just want to be a part of that person's world that can draw me in. But then I discover like, oh, the only way they're able to do that is by being a total workaholic and having no time for me. And
nailed it. Oh my
God. You know, and so it can or like, oh, I'm an introvert and it's fun to be with an extrovert for a little while, but then I need like some, I do need some quiet time at some point. And
yeah. So kind of like with that spendthrift tightwad framework, yeah. Like the tightwad has been so restricted, they meet the spender and they're like, oh, this is what freedom around spending is like. Heck to the yeah, this is cool.
It's yes.
And then you get 2 months, 3 months, whatever the time, and then you're like, oh crap, my bank account is below $20,000. Oh my God. Blah, 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 yeah. And meanwhile, the spendthrift is like, chill, dude, you still got $20,000 in the bank. It's cool.
Yes.
Is that what we're talking yeah. about?
It is. And where you start facing some higher stakes decisions. You know, it's, yes. you know, maybe it's harmless when you're just dating and things right. are low stakes, but, or there's like kids involved. Like I can put up with your quirks when it's just you and me, but
oh.
when I see you shaping the next generation, it's like, okay.
That brings now, war.
Yeah, right.
And I don't say that jokingly. Like it legit becomes war for some couples because how we spend money does get tied into our values and our moral systems. And like, you know, there's people that are worried about rampant consumerism. And so that becomes an angle that like spendthrifts can definitely get hammered on.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's lots of facets to this. And man, wow, this has been a fun interview.
Oh, I think so. I've enjoyed it.
So Scott, outside of your incredible book, how else can people connect with you?
Yeah. Well, you can check out my website, which has a lot of the research that the book is based on, scottrick.com. And yeah, I'm around. I'm on all the socials. I'm new to Instagram. My name was taken, so I got at Likely Shopping, which I think is a good fit for me. So
I love it.
Yeah, but I love connecting with people who are curious about this stuff. And yeah, feel free to reach out and I'm around.
Yes. Well, I'll be creating an Instagram post on this one by the time this podcast episode comes out. Who knows where that post will be. But
yeah,
Scott, it's been an incredible pleasure to meet you and have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Ed, so nice to meet you and talk with you. Thank you.
I invite you now to stop for 5 or 10 minutes and reflect on what you just heard. Maybe even journal about it. Give yourself the time to consider what you just heard and what it means to you. By giving yourself the time to reflect and integrate what you just heard, it will help you along your journey of learning, healing, and growing towards financial intimacy in your life. Please like and follow this podcast and share it with someone that would benefit from being on the journey of financial intimacy. Wishing you healthy love and money, Ed.